Simultaneously broadcasting from the throne of the north and deep in the middle of nowhere, our hosts Parhesia and Valhal are bringing you the ATS Estrogen Podcast Show and the topics that two dames think we really need to discuss. Hello everyone, this is Parhesia and Valhal coming to you from AboveTopSecret.com. This is our introductory podcast of AT Estrogen, and in this show we hope to highlight and showcase interesting news stories that have been sort of cast aside by the mainstream media but haven't left our minds, and we hope to bring them back to your minds. We also hope to bring on interesting guests who can share their personal stories with us and hopefully broaden all of our horizons and make us think of things differently and look at things differently and in a critical way so we can all learn from each other. This is all about collaboration, and we will be having some very interesting guests.
Yeah, I'm really excited about the idea of having some of the members of ATS join us. We hope to have some of the women come in as a third member of our team on certain weeks, but also we look forward to interviewing some of the members on AboveTopSecret.com who have brought some really interesting personal stories to the board and may not have any other way to personally get their story out to more people.
And it'll be an excellent opportunity because ATS podcasting is just taking off, and there are plenty of listeners and tons of people just, you know, ready to learn and ready to listen and open to tons of different things. And that's what's great about ATS. There's just so many different people here, and we can all draw on each other's information that we bring and learn from each other.
Yep.
Tonight we wanted to talk about a couple of stories that have left the collective consciousness of most people, in the West anyway, kind of separated from the reality of the rest of the world, and specifically the aftermath of the Asian tsunami of 2004.
Yeah, we actually talked about finding out how things were going over there. You and I did, what was it, maybe back in June?
Maybe May.
That's right. And I took that on, I took that on and started trying to contact some various government agencies and aid agencies back at that time to find out how things were progressing in the cleanup and the reconstruction efforts. And I could not get anyone to return an email. It was like everyone had gone away. And so the whole issue of how that area of the world has handled the immense cleanup and reconstruction due to that tsunami is just untold in the media.
And when you consider the death toll is between 270,000 and 300,000, you know, I don't recall hearing anything about how the disposal of the bodies was handled. I remember hearing about Thailand burning bodies, but that was just of locals, whereas the foreigners were sent back to their home countries, claimed by their families. And Valhal brought up an interesting point earlier about, you know, how do you go about disposing of that many bodies? Those are huge mass graves, and then when you think about the amount of deaths in general, what about all the orphan children? For a while there was quite a lot of talk about child trafficking and how Indonesia had brought forth stricter laws about taking Indonesian children out of the country. But you didn't hear much about that after that. Again, it was, you know, stricken from the record and the media forgot about it. And, you know, alongside, so did the readers. And with that many people dead, there's got to be a lot of parentless children, and where did they go? What are the state of the orphanages? You know, what is happening in the countries? What's happening to the children?
Are they being loved? Are they being taken care of properly? Have they just become a mouth to to feed as little as you have to. It's a really upsetting thought that, I mean, they had said that up to 30%, I thought, 30% of the affected people in the areas were children that had been left without any parents. Mm-hmm. And you just wonder. You wonder if, well, the infrastructure was torn down in the first place, so it's not like you can assume that there were ample amounts of orphanages to take that many kids, you know, that were operating at that point.
It's a lot of kids to take. And, you know, we really don't know what happened to them. And then there's also the issue of kind of reuniting parents with their children that got separated from them. How did that go? And also, I think another important question unrelated, well, not entirely unrelated, but to the children is what happened to the aid money that, you know, pretty much every country sent? How was it used? Is it being used to rebuild? Because, again, we haven't heard anything. We haven't heard of the progresses or failures of what's going on over there.
So, yeah. Another really interesting issue you had brought up connected with this was the lack of news reports of any disease outbreaks. And we have to assume that. Well, we don't have to assume anything. You kind of want to assume that that means that they were lucky enough there were no disease outbreaks. Mm-hmm. But we have no way of knowing that. And it's astonishing to think about that you have upwards of 300,000 bodies to dispose of in a fairly tropical region. And
stagnant.
They were able to get it done without any diseases breaking out.
You know, with all the water sitting around and, you know, malaria is a huge threat, cholera, tons of different diseases.
I saw that picture that I told you about shortly after the tsunami, and it was, I want to say it was in Thailand, but it was just this little lagoon, this little bay, and it was entirely covered with human bodies. Debris and human bodies, for as far as you could see.
And that's what a lot of the pictures that you saw from the area were, just bodies and wreckage and water and filth. And it really is hard to believe that no outbreaks of disease came from that. And like you said before, you know, maybe we underestimate their capabilities of maintaining and handling things, but it just seems that, you know, even in the best of places, you know, look at what happened in New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina. There were the beginnings of some cases of some
dysentery.
Yeah. And all of that. And, you know, I don't recall hearing much about that from the area stricken by the tsunami. So it really does make you wonder.
Well, we're just going to have to dedicate some time to getting some answers on these. And my real life job, I have some connections down in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll get a hold of some people that way, and I'll ask if they can just give some kind of personal account that maybe we can come back and share with people.
Well, I hope so, because it would be really great to hear about what's going on there, the progresses, how people are faring, because I guess 8 months ago, 9 months ago, when the coverage basically stopped, things still weren't very good. How could they be?
No,
there was complete destruction of so many places, and when you consider that Indonesia was hit pretty hard by it all, and then you think now there's the whole avian flu thing going on there. How does the destruction of infrastructure in certain areas, how does that affect that?
Almost definitely. From the time that we started hearing of the cases in Indonesia, that was the first thing that crossed my mind is this happening in an area that's still ravaged by that tsunami? Have they ever rebuilt their hospitals? Do they have adequate medical facilities anywhere in the region? And But I'm hoping that the aid money has been used in a proper way.
I hope so, too. Because, you know, I get it's kind of selfish, but, you know, if it hasn't been, and things aren't being rebuilt in Indonesia, and avian flu is present there, there are epidemics, then it certainly can affect us all.
Yep.
Something else that we had been kind of mulling over for the past couple of days was something that hit kind of closer to home for people on AboveTopSecret.com. For anyone who's been a member of the website for more than the last 10 months or so, they'll probably remember that one of our posters was the shooter on the Red Lake Reservation in Minnesota. Jeff Wise was the shooter, and he was a member here, and there's been a lot of lack of information regarding what's going on in that case. The son of the tribal chief of the Red Lake Reserve in Minnesota was one of Jeff Wise's friends, and he was arrested shortly after the shootings occurred in March, I believe, and it was never disclosed why he was arrested, and he was subsequently charged with something, we don't know what. And just recently, his trial started last week, and it's closed to the media, so there's basically a media blackout. They're not reporting because they can't. And I think what we're wondering is, why can't they report? What's being hid here? Why is the charge not being disclosed, and why is the trial closed? Because they say that the judge, Donovan Frank, says that it's being blacked out to protect him from stigma and public scrutiny. But we were speaking earlier, and Val Hal mentioned that, what's he being protected from? You know, what if the charge is completely unrelated to the shootings that happened? He's not being protected from speculation.
That's true. And I am so interested in this story now that you've brought up some of the more stranger things with this friend. I remember that Weiss's grandfather, who he lived with, and his grandfather and mother were the first people he killed. And I believe his grandfather was either an acting police officer on the reservation at the time, or he was retired. I can't remember which. But it's interesting that this kid, who's currently on trial, his father is also a police officer there, correct?
Yep. The father is the chief of the Red Lake Reserve.
Oh, well, that's a little bit more. That's so interesting. And another, there are so many facets to the Weiss story itself that I think we could take one facet and we'd have an endless show from every facet that there is. There is the Lost Children of America, and that's what Jeff was.
Absolutely.
I don't know what the story was with his mother and father and why they weren't the caregivers in his life, but the initial stories that came out after he killed himself was that his grandfather was not a very loving person, that he basically had a place to live, but he wasn't given any kind of paternal love from his grandfather.
It wasn't a home.
I don't think it was. I mean, the descriptions of his grandfather were basically that he was a hard ass. I mean, that's what it equates to. And so I think maybe the kid had a lot of pressure there. But he also had some emotional problems, and they had apparently been trained to treat these with what I think is the bane of existence, and that's the SSRI medicines that are overly prescribed, not monitored correctly. And quite frankly, Frisia, I believe that one of the greatest cover-ups that have occurred, I mean, that would just make the tobacco issue look like child's play, is what's going on with the SSRIs.
I know exactly what you mean, and I think that would be an interesting topic to pursue more in depth in the future with, you know, potentially with other parents on the board who have had their children exposed to these things, or who have had people try and force them on their children.
Oh, absolutely. That would be so interesting. And as I've shared with you, I went through my own personal experience when my 7 years, it took 7 years to get my son diagnosed with what is called the limbic dysfunction. And the only reason we actually got that diagnosis is after 7 years and some inpatient time and a number of EEG, different types of EEGs, a neurologist got involved who had studied under a doctor at Bethesda, Maryland, who had basically found the limbic dysfunction. They had gone to prisons and done research on what was considered habitual criminals, and they had found that it was more than 90% of the habitual criminals had limbic dysfunctions. And the limbic system is basically the part of the brain that controls your emotions. And a limbic dysfunction is basically an epilepsy of the emotion center. And the reason it took 7 years to get this diagnosis is because my son's years of battling this were at the time that the use of Ritalin was peaking. And just about every kid in America was being put on Ritalin. And I am staunchly against maintenance drugs, and especially when they come in the form of speed. And I fought that because the best diagnosis I could get that would warrant putting my son on Ritalin was that he was borderline ADHD. Well, I would take him to another doctor and he'd say, no, he is not. He does not test as ADHD. So I held out and I kept taking him to specialists until one day, 7 years later, we finally found out the real physiological, neurological problems. And he's this wonderful man now. He just turned 21 this year, and he's getting on with his life. He never had to take any kind of mood-altering drugs. It's so hard to find this stuff out, Parisia.
I know, absolutely. And the fact that you held out for 7 years, I think, is very unique because, you know, the quick fix with regard to medicine is just another symptom of our society who just want everything quick, quick, quick. And holding out for 7 years meant that you had to deal with the problem. And how many people would do that? It seems that the pill is the quick fix and, you know, you give it to your kid and they're going to be okay.
Which could be a whole nother show. Because there really are questions and I personally have some theories. I've read some very interesting theories on how the generation, which would basically be my generation, how they became such piss poor parents. what led to that, and what led to them wanting to take the easy out when it came to the greatest responsibility we can have in our lives. And so many parents took the easy way out.
And continue to do so.
And yes.
And it's problematic because these drugs are still being pushed.
Yes, they are.
The kids aren't getting any better, though.
No, they're not. No, I had one doctor describe it in the very best way I've ever heard it. If you have a child who has a problem that needs to be diagnosed and needs to be addressed, and you put, okay, let's say he's ADHD, and he goes to school and he spends the 6 to 8 hours in total failure because he can't concentrate, he can't maintain his composure, and so he goes through 6 hours of failure, he rides the bus home, probably gets in trouble. And when he gets off the bus in front of his house, he picks up a rock and he throws it at the bus as it drives away. You put that same kid on Ritalin without addressing any emotional problems, and he has the very same day of failure. He may slow down a bit. He may he may be able to hear a little bit more. But he's still battling a failure for 6 hours. And when he gets off the bus in front of his house, he has slowed down enough to pick out the perfect rock to throw at the bus as it drives away. And I think that says it all.
And, you know, in light of that example, and when you think of that in the context of all the school shootings that have happened over the past 10 years or so, it makes sense.
It does make sense. And then when you add in the tremendous cover-up that has taken place in the SSRI category of medicines, and the fact that research was withheld from the FDA that showed up to 60% of the people who were studied showed homicidal or suicidal tendencies while on SSRIs such as Paxil, Zoloft, the whole gamut of them.
Mm-hmm.
That was suppressed from the FDA review of these drugs. And these pharmaceutical companies have never been called on it.
The whole FDA approval issues and stuff like that and testing is just so big. And it encompasses so many things, not just the SSRIs. It really is amazing to think of, you know, what are we putting in our bodies? What are we putting in the bodies of our children?
Absolutely.
And why, you know, why are these things being approved? And why are people so quick to use them?
Well, really, that's another story. That's another show. Because I wonder why people don't understand that they are the final decider on their health, on how they'll maintain it, and how they'll treat their bodies. Doctors aren't gods. We don't hand over our brain when we walk in the waiting room.
No.
And people just need to be more educated.
Yes. And I think this is the perfect time to call out for people who have had experiences with these sorts of drugs.
Yes.
What has happened to your children? Who has tried to force this on your children? Because I know here in Canada, the teachers will recommend that your child go on it if they need more attention than they can give. My cousin, who is, I don't know how old she is now, but when she was maybe 8 or 9, her teacher recommended that she go on it. So she was sent to psychiatrist after psychiatrist and doctor after doctor, and, you know, she went on it. And she was on it for about 6 years, and she completely changed after that. And finally, her mother decided, you know, enough. I'm taking her off of this. And she took it off, and you know what? There was a beautiful little girl after that.
That's right.
She became, I don't know, she just started loving life. Whereas before, she was just kind of trudging on. You know, it wasn't helping her. And her mother, you know, decided to work with it through her, you know, and with her rather than, here you go, honey, here's your pill.
Right.
And it helped. She's better now, and she's, you know, grown up and happy. And it was quite obvious that that wasn't the answer for her, and made me wonder even more, why are people being prescribed this when it's not helping them? And is it really helping someone if their personality completely changed and they're not lively anymore? Especially children.
Right. I mean, that should be the happiest times of their lives.
Yes. And that kind of brings into it another issue, you know. Does a teacher really have a right to tell you your kid should be on medication? I don't think so. I don't think so either. There's my cat.
Hi, kitty. Now, we should warn everyone that we've got one special guest coming up on a show that's coming soon. Maynard. We might just give him a heads up.
Yep, Maynard is from Alabama, and he'll be sharing with us something very intriguing. You won't want to miss it.
And with that, I would like to add, every once in a while, we're going to have one heap of a help and of humor. So,
You can't have the seriousness without the humor.
That's right. Oh, by the way, Parisia, what are you drinking?
I'm having a Crown and Coke with a twist of lemon. How about you?
Cheap wine.
Cheers.
Here's to you.
Thank you. Well, everyone, I hope you've enjoyed our introductory show, and as Vahal just mentioned, tune in soon because we'll be bringing an extra special, super-duper cool guest that everyone will love. And it is related to one of our conspiracy forums.
Yes.
And is aimed to address first-person accounts and verification of a very, very strange and unlikely event. But it'll be wonderful.
And with that, I think we'll say goodnight.
I think so. Good night, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.